cold fear. The fear of the murderer disposing of the body, which would give deadly evidence against...
I laid the carpet in the backyard and threw about 20 or 30 buckets of water on it to try to wash the blood off. And the colour of the water that came off was like blood.
Next thing I remember was something scratching and pulling at my mouth. I opened my eyes, and Jean was lying there under me, and I had my hands around her throat.
Murder Most Foul. 6 classic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 1, The Surgeon's Knife.
Members of the jury, on the 29th of September 1935, Miss Susan Johnston was walking along the Moffat Edinburgh Road near Garden Home Lynn Bridge. As she was crossing the bridge, she did what many people do. She looked down into the gully below and saw what she thought was an arm lying in the bed of the stream. She went back to the hotel. There she saw her brother, and as a result of what she said to him, the brother went down to the water's edge and saw a forearm and head which were wrapped, or partly wrapped, in newspaper.
That was how Mr. Justice Singleton began his summing up at the Manchester Assizes on Friday, the 13th of March, 1935. The jury had to concern itself with bits and pieces of human bodies. And so shall we, because this was one of the first cases in which scientific and medical evidence was to play a central part. Subsequent searches by the police discovered well over 50 portions of body, or rather bodies. A second head was found. The grisly job of reassembling these human jigsaws was carried out by a team led by Professor John Glaister, the Regius Professor of Forensic Medicine at Glasgow University.
Exhibit 135 contains photographs of what are termed head number one. It can be seen that the eyes have been removed, some facial skin, the tissues of the nose. You will also notice the removal of 2 central teeth. Exhibit 139 shows the head of body number 2. The tissue was removed to a greater extent than in number 1. As in the other body, the eyes have been removed, the skin of the face, the soft tissues of the nose. Also, both ears, nearly all the scalp tissues bearing hair, the lips, and a portion of the tongue had been...
And so it went on. The prosecution would describe the bodies as having been horribly mutilated. But there was more to it than that. And if they could indeed be said to have been mutilated, well, the mutilation had been done by an expert. For instance, they hadn't been crudely chopped up, but disarticulated. That is to say, surgically severed at suitable joints.
Professor Glaister, this disarticulation... Would this require any surgical skill?
Indeed it would, my lord, and definite anatomical knowledge.
What kind of knife would be required?
Probably a Symes amputation knife and an ordinary scalpel. In the case of body number 2, about 5 hours would be needed to complete the work.
And how long had the bodies been in the river? Some of the pieces of flesh were wrapped in a torn sheet, others in a blouse. One of the heads was in a child's romper suit. But other remains were found wrapped in newspapers. These were of various dates from early August onwards. The most recent was the Sunday Graphic of September the 15th, just a fortnight prior to their discovery. Scotland Yard's Black Museum still holds copies of the fragments of that Sunday Graphic. There's part of the front page numbered and dated September the 15th, 1935. It seems the great attraction was Lady Londonderry's frank memoirs. One of the other scraps is torn from an inside page. There's half a photograph of a line of young women and what's left of the headline, which reads AMBE apostrophe S, Carnival Queen Crowned. That headline was to save the police months of sifting through files of missing persons. To return to the trial.
I am Edwin Vaughan Morris. I'm circulation manager of the Sunday Graphic and News newspaper. These sections of newspaper shown to me are from a special slip or local edition of the Sunday Graphic of the 15th of September 1935, of which 3,700 copies were printed. They were circulated only in Morecambe, Lancaster and the immediate vicinity, and they contained photographs of the crowning of Morecambe's Carnival Queen.
At once, the investigation shifted to Morecambe, the seaside resort, and the nearby ancient town of Lancaster, which in 1935 had 40,000 inhabitants. Among them was an Indian doctor, probably the only Indian doctor in Lancaster at that time. He lived in a dour, three-story, respectable, stone-fronted house at No. 2 Dalton Square. He was, by all accounts, an able general practitioner and popular with his patients. But recently, the doctor, whose name was Buck Ruxton, had been behaving rather strangely, as reported by a detective called John Thomas Moffat.
I'm a detective inspector in the Lancashire County Constabulary stationed at Blackburn. On September the 24th, I was in the Lancaster police office investigating the death of the Mrs. Smalley. One of those I interviewed was Mrs. Kerwin, who works part-time for Dr. Ruxton. Between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, Dr. Ruxton himself came to the police station, though I had not requested to see him.
Look here, Inspector Moffat. What the hell do the police want making inquiries about my private affairs for? I do not know Mrs. Smalley. I have enough trouble on my mind. Come across and search my house and interview the whole damn lot of us. It is nothing but professional jealousy. I am the most progressive doctor in this town. I have over 2,000 patients on my panel, and every doctor is jealous
of me. At that point, he held up his hand. His little finger was heavily bandaged, and the bandage twisted round his hand at the same time.
Look at my finger. I cut that and almost severed it with a fruit tin I was opening for my children last week. I'm the most miserable man on earth. My wife leaves me. Now you come bothering me. I come home from visiting my patients a fortnight ago. I go to my study and call her name. No answer. I go to her room. I find a note. It says, I am going away. Don't worry. Leaves me with 3 kids crying for their mother. And I do not know where she is. I know nothing about Mrs. Smalley. It is professional jealousy. And you will hear more about it.
Nobody had ever imagined him to be involved in Mrs. Smalley's death. But it was true, Dr. Ruxton's wife had disappeared. Except that she wasn't his wife, they were never married. And it wasn't a fortnight before, but only a week ago, the day Dr. Ruxton had cut his hand, September the 15th. And on the same day, their maidservant, Mary Rogerson, had also disappeared. She was 20, she always visited her father and her stepmother in Morecambe every weekend. On October the 1st, when she'd failed to visit them for 3 weekends running, they informed the police.
My name is Agnes Oxley, and I'm employed as charwoman at the Ruxtons. It was some time after the two women had disappeared that the doctor, who was in bed, called me to his bedside. He asked me to sit down, and he read out an account of the Ravine murder in the Daily Express. He said, "So you see, Mrs. Oxley, it is a man and a woman. It's not our two." I replied that I hope not. He then began to laugh.
On the 11th of October, Dr. Ruxton finally went to see Captain Van, the chief constable of Lancaster, to report his wife missing. Later, he returned with a copy of the Daily Express, which had continued covering the story, and he even mentioned the missing Mary Rogerson.
Look here, my dear Van. Can't you do something about these newspaper reports? Look at this. This newspaper says that this woman has a full set of teeth in the lower jaw. And I know to my own knowledge that Mary Rogerson had at least 4 teeth missing in this jaw.
He'd been calm till then, my lord, but now he became excited. He waved his arms about, he sat on the table with his feet on the chair, and he began to bang on the chair in a very violent manner. His conduct was very extraordinary.
It is all the fault of that damned Bobby Edmondson. Captain Van, he's ruining my home. He's having an affair with my belle, my wife. I know it.
He came to see me next day at 9:30 in the evening. He remained at the police station overnight and, at my request, wrote out an account of his movements from the 14th to the 30th of September. He also made and signed a voluntary statement which he dictated and afterwards corrected and initialed.
The statement is true. to the best of my recollection at the present moment. I have nothing further to add. At the present moment. There, my dear Van, it is signed.
Good. Now listen very carefully to me. I intend to prefer a very serious charge against you. You are charged that between the 14th and 29th of September 1935, you did feloniously and with malice aforethought kill and murder one Mary Jane Rogerson.
What?
I must caution you that anything...
Sir, say... most emphatically not. Of course not.
Dr. Ruxton.
The furthest thing from my mind. What are you talking about?
Dr. Ruxton, I must caution you that anything you say...
It was not until November the 5th, 1935, that he was charged with the murder of Mrs. Ruxton. And it was for this crime, not the murder of Mary Rogerson, that he was brought to trial 5 months later.
How say you, Buck Ruxton? Are you guilty or not guilty?
I plead not guilty.
The jury was sworn in and had their first sight of the prisoner. He was then aged 36. He was a handsome man, born in Bombay, of good family. Details of his background would come out when he was questioned by his own counsel, the distinguished KC, Norman Burkitt.
You are a doctor of medicine, a bachelor of medicine. I hold first-class honours in medicine from Bombay University. I studied in London, but I did not qualify there finally.
Do you have any other degrees?
Yes, bachelor of surgery, also at the University of Bombay.
Silence in court.
Did you have any medical experience before your medical practice in Lancaster in 1930?
If I may modestly say, considerable.
In the year 1928, you were in Edinburgh pursuing your medical studies at the university.
Yes.
Was it at that time you first met Mrs. Ruxton?
Yes.
Isabella Carr was her maiden name, was it not?
If you want to be precise, Kerr, not Carr.
Mm-hmm. Her name being, as I understand it, Isabella Van Ness.
She married a Dutchman. The marriage only lasted a few months. I knew her as Isabella Carr.
In 1930, you went to Lancaster, having bought a practice there.
Yes.
And she went with you to 2 Dalton Square.
Yes.
That is where you lived together and subsequently had the children.
Yes, but I had one child born before, Elizabeth. Diane and Billy were born at 2 Dalton Square.
What would you say about your relations with Mrs. Ruxton, in general, during the years from 1930 to 1935?
If I may be permitted to put it in appropriate English, we were the kind of people who could not live with each other and could not live without each other.
Of all the words spoken during the 11 days of the trial, these were the ones most remembered. We couldn't live with each other, and we couldn't live without each other. Ruxton himself was the only witness called by the defence. And before he had a chance to speak, the prosecution would have called no less than 106 witnesses. Several servants and ex-servants testified that they'd witnessed violence between Ruxton and Isabella. He denied this, describing what they'd seen as love play. But he couldn't deny that she had once appealed for help from the police and had fled to her sisters in Scotland. Robert Edmondson was called, the man whom Ruxton accused of having an affair with his wife. He didn't seem the type, somehow. Nonetheless, Dr. Ruxton was known to be a jealous man in these matters. Mr. Jackson, the prosecutor, also called a number of witnesses to give evidence about Ruxton's behaviour on September the 15th and the days that followed, including Mrs. Oxley, the Ruxton's charlady.
According to your duties, you should have gone to the doctor's house on the morning of September the 15th.
Yes, I intended to go, but Dr. Ruxton came to my house at 6:30. My husband went down and I stood on the stairs. Dr. Ruxton said, "Tell Mrs. Oxley not to bother to come this morning, as Mrs. Ruxton and Mary have gone to Edinburgh and I'm taking the children to Morecambe."
But you went there at your usual time on the Monday.
Yes, but I could get no reply. I returned at about 9:15 and rang again. Dr. Ruxton then arrived in his car. He had no collar and tie on and had not had a shave. His hand was bandaged. I asked him about it.
What did he say?
He said he had cut it on a tin opener and had lost gallons and gallons of blood.
Many witnesses mentioned this cut hand, which Ruxton attributed to the accident opening a tin of peaches. But in the period after his arrest, it was examined by another doctor, another prosecution witness, Dr. Shannon.
I am a registered medical practitioner and am the medical officer at HM Prison at Strangeways.
Dr. Shannon, in your opinion, how was the wound on Dr. Ruxton's hand caused?
In my opinion, it was caused by some very sharp instrument which slipped and passed through the hand, and the severity of the two lower cuts probably caused the release of the grip.
So the knife, or instrument, slipped in some way.
Mm.
You know a surgeon's cutting knife, Doctor, a Syme's knife.
Yes.
If anyone is cutting up a body, are there any difficulties in regard to the knife?
Oh, yes, sir, there are several. The blood can make the handle very slippery, for instance.
I see. I have here a tin opener of the sort described by the prisoner. Could this have caused the wounds on the hand?
Certainly not.
There was other, more ingenious medical evidence to come from Professor Glaister and his team. Mr. Jackson set great store by proving that the remains discovered in the river were indeed those of the missing Isabella Ruxton and Mary Rogerson. To have reassembled the bodies, or what was left of them, called for great skill. But even then, how to identify them when they'd been so badly mutilated? In his opening speech, Mr. Jackson argued that the very nature of the mutilations helped to identify the bodies.
Let us first consider body number one, the younger woman. Mary Rogerson had what is commonly called a glide, a form of squint, in one eye. The eyes had been removed. She had certain teeth drawn by a dentist, a fact which could have been identified by that dentist. More extractions had been made, and these had been made about the time of her death. She had four vaccination marks on her left arm, rather than the usual three. A piece of skin with four vaccination marks was found. She had a very bad birthmark on her right arm, a very noticeable mark. The flesh on that forearm...
And so it went on. Naturally, Norman Burkitt, for the defence, would argue that since Ruxton was on trial for the murder of Mrs. Ruxton, evidence about her maid was quite irrelevant. But as the two women had lived in the same house, disappeared on the same day, and their bodies were mingled in the same gruesome bundles, Mr. Justice Singleton considered such evidence was acceptable.
Now, with regard to the other body, which we say is that of Mrs. Ruxton, in strangulation, certain portions of the body become discoloured. The whites of the eyes, for instance. The eyes were removed. The ears would show discoloration. They were cut off. The lips, too. They were also cut off.
Mrs. Ruxton had very thick ankles. Mrs. Oxley said her legs were the same thickness from her knees downwards. She also had humped toes. The flesh of the lower leg and the toes were missing from this body, as were the ends of the fingers, and Mrs. Ruxton had very distinctly manicured fingernails. The most spectacular positive evidence for identification of the body came from Professor Glaister's colleague, Professor Brash. He superimposed a photograph of skull number two onto a photograph of Isabella Ruxton. It's a ghostly, striking picture, making real T.S. Eliot's line about being able to see the skull beneath the skin. The two most certainly seemed to fit, and yet neither professor was prepared to state categorically that these were the bodies of the two missing women. And in English law, if there is reasonable doubt, the prisoner has to be given the benefit of it, as Norman Burkitt was to point out to the jury.
The true verdict, according to the evidence, must always bear in mind the golden rule. The case must be proved, and proved beyond all reasonable doubt. The decision you have to make, members of the jury, is irrevocable. If you have any doubt, if there is an avenue, let the prisoner walk down it to freedom.
The prosecution made much of the definite identification of the bodies. It was a key point in Mr. Jackson's speech for the Crown. But did this identification prove Buck Ruxton guilty? That was a question Norman Burkitt seized upon.
Members of the jury, I was astonished to hear my learned friend Mr. Jackson say to you that if you were satisfied that the bodies found in the ravine were those of Mrs. Ruxton and Mary Rogerson, then your task was nigh completed. No. Even if you are thus satisfied, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it does not prove the case. If four simple words of the prisoner are true, they left my house. Then, as far as he is concerned, there is an end to it, whatever may have happened to the two unfortunate women later. The Crown must prove the fact of murder and satisfy you that they died by the hand of the prisoner.
In other words, just because the bodies were those of Mrs. Ruxton and her maid, it didn't mean Dr. Ruxton had killed them. They could have set off to Edinburgh, as he said, and been murdered on the way by person or persons unknown. It was proved that a Sunday Graphic had been delivered to the Ruxton's house that Sunday, but what would have been more natural than that Mrs. Ruxton should have taken the newspaper with her? It was proved that the blouse in which some of the remains were found had belonged to Mary, but might she not have been wearing it? But what about the children's rompers in which one of the heads had been found? Mr. Justice Singleton made much of these. He even waved them at the jury during his summing up.
Mary Rogerson might have taken the blouse with her, but what about these rompers? Is there the slightest doubt about these rompers? If Mrs. Ruxton and Mary Rogerson went away without the children, would they take these rompers?
They certainly seemed an unlikely thing to take when you're fleeing from your family. But perhaps the most damning evidence of all was the blood. There was no way of proving it came from the two murdered women, but there was an awful lot of it lying about at 2 Dalton Square. On the afternoon of Sunday the 15th, Buck Ruxton had asked one of his patients to come and help clear up, a Mrs. Hampshire. He was expecting the decorators, he said, and as he'd cut his hand, he couldn't do it himself. When she arrived, she found the carpets taken up.
You went into the yard, Mrs. Hampshire. What did you see there?
Several carpets. Two landing carpets, the rest were stair carpets.
Was there anything about those carpets?
They were stained. One in particular was heavily stained with blood.
Was there anything else in the yard?
A blood-stained shirt and some badly stained towels.
Had anything else happened to the towels?
They had been half-burned. There was also an empty packet of Lux thrown down at the bottom of the stairs.
I believe the doctor then went out.
Yes. He returned later with Elizabeth and Diane. He said he had come to fetch the children's nightdresses as they were going to stay with Mrs. Anderson. He went upstairs while I did the washing up in the kitchen.
When the doctor came downstairs, did he invite you anywhere?
Yes, into the waiting room.
What did he say there?
He said that if the carpets and the suit were of any use to us, we could have them. He said that the suit was badly stained, but that it was a good suit, and I could have it cleaned. It was badly stained with blood. He said he had worn it that morning when he had cut his finger.
In Professor Glaister's report on the jacket and trousers, he lists 27 blood stains, many of them between 8 inches and a foot long and 3 or 4 inches wide, and all, so Dr. Ruxton asserted, from a cut finger. The waistcoat was so badly bloodstained that Mrs. Hampshire had burned it. Next morning, while Mrs. Oxley had knocked in vain at his door, Dr. Ruxley was visiting Mrs. Hampshire, looking, as Mrs. Oxley said, unshaven and dishevelled. He'd offered to take the suit back to have it cleaned, but Mrs. Hampshire said she'd do it. After he left, she opened the bundle of carpets.
One was not so bad, and one had just one blood mark on it. But the amount of blood on the third carpet was terrible. It was still damp with it. I laid the carpet in the backyard and threw about 20 or 30 buckets of water on it to try to wash the blood off. And the colour of the water that came off was like blood. I threw it on the line and left it to dry, and when it was wash day, I had another go. And still, I still couldn't get the congealed blood off.
Still all from one cut finger. Other prosecution witnesses gave evidence about the blood at 2 Dalton Square, among them Mrs. Oxley and Professor John Glaister. Two girls told of late-night bonfires and when all 106 of Mr. Jackson's prosecution witnesses had had their say, Norman Burkitt's sole witness for the defence took his stand, Dr. Ruxton, who made a pathetic and hardly impressive figure. The report on the trial frequently includes the comment, in brackets, prisoner burst into tears. It happened several times when Norman Burkitt was questioning him about Mrs. Hampshire's evidence.
Mrs. Hampshire has said that you called at her house about 9 o'clock on Monday morning.
Yes, I heard her say that, without a collar and tie.
Were you at Mrs. Hampshire's house on that Monday morning?
Never. Never in my life. I have never gone from my house in all my life without a tie and collar. Never in my life.
She said you were without a tie and collar, and that you were wearing an old, dirty raincoat.
That is ridiculous, if I may say. I'm so fastidious about my looks, especially as 40,000 people in Lancaster know me. And could anyone imagine on that busy Monday morning I would allow them to see Dr. Ruxton at 9 o'clock in the morning without a collar and tie? Never in my life. And in a dirty raincoat. It is a lie.
Mrs. Hampshire says you inquired about the blue suit.
I was never at her house on Monday morning. I cannot stand these lies. This is all a pack of lies they are telling.
Please, try to keep control.
It is very hard to stand this pack of lies.
There were many other witnesses whom he accused of lying, including Mrs. Oxley. And there were many other occasions when he broke down in tears. Curiously, he stood up to the prosecution cross-examination rather better, though he had an unfortunate quirk, constantly addressing Mr. Jackson as my friend, which was anything but the case. Eventually, after 11 days, the speeches ended, the jury retired. They were out for scarcely over an hour.
Do you find Buck Ruxton guilty of murder or not guilty?
Guilty.
You find Buck Ruxton guilty of murder, and that is the verdict of you all?
Yes.
Buck Ruxton, you have been convicted of murder upon the verdict of the jury. Have you anything to say why sentence of death should not be passed according to law?
Subject to the point that I be allowed to appeal in the administration of justice, I submit that to your lordship and the jury. I want to thank everybody for the patience and fairness of my trial.
The appeal failed, and he was hanged on the 12th of May, 1936. It's said that although he was in a very agitated state for some time before his death, he went to the gallows calmly. At the time, the sentimental ballad Red Sails in the Sunset was immensely popular.
Red sails in the sunset, way out on the sea. Oh, carry my loved one home safely to me.
Street urchins developed their own version. Red stains on the carpet, red stains on your knife. Oh, Dr. Buck Ruxton, you cut up your wife. The nursemaid, she saw you and threatened to tell. So, Dr. Buck Ruxton, you killed her as well. And they were probably correct.
Oh, carry my loved one home safely to me.
In The Surgeon's Knife, Mark Zuber played Buck Ruxton and Anthony Bate played Norman Burkitt. Other parts were played by Danielle Allen, Timothy Bateson, Timothy Carlton, Nigel Carrington, Fraser Carr, and Michael Turner. Murder Most Foul is written by John Scottney and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Mark Savage.